The war that began on October the 7th is 6 months old. We're going to look at how it's playing out on the ground, in the diaspora, and indeed for those people most directly caught up in it. It's Unholy. I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London.
And I'm Yonit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv. It's unholy to Jews on the News. You know, I was up north right by the border this week, Jonathan, and I had this question for one of the top IDF commanders there, and I asked, like, tell me the truth. On October 7th, did you think that this would be where we are 6 months after? And he said, you know, we thought in October, to be honest, we'd be home lighting candles with our families in December, in Hanukkah. It's the Jewish version of we'd be home for Christmas. And kind of little did we know it would take six long months and no end in sight, really, not for the North and not for anywhere else.
Yes. I mean, no end in sight, meaning we could be back here in 6 months' time thinking, well, 6 months was the least of it. And it's one of the things we're going to get into in the multiple conversations we're going to have. Because we're doing a sort of special episode this time, getting three different perspectives on this ongoing war, hearing about the war on the ground militarily from the brilliant military analyst Amos Harel. We're going to be speaking about how this is playing out in the diaspora. It's been one of our ongoing themes throughout all our conversations on this, and even actually how it's affecting people in terms of their faith spiritually with Rabbi Angela Buchdahl. And hearing very directly about the hostages and their families with friend of the podcast, Biana Golodriga. So we've got a lot to talk about, a lot to focus on at this milestone, which right now, as you say, felt as if we were, you know, it was going to be very, very much out of reach. I remember you and I talking in November and you saying you were hearing from, you know, military planners that maybe this was going to have to go on into January. And my heart sinking, thinking, got January and more of it. And now it's April. And, well, we'll talk about it with some of our guests, but my worry is, you know, maybe this is really no end in sight and just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, and you know, there's a quote coming out of the head of military intelligence, Aharon Khalifa, obviously a man who will have a lot to answer for when the war is over, saying in a closed meeting, maybe the worst is not yet behind us. He's referring specifically to the, you know, concerns in Israel about the imminent Iranian response to an assassination attributed to Israel of a top Iranian commander. It connects obviously to the fact that the whole situation on the northern border is still not resolved. Are we going to a full-scale war with Hezbollah, or are we, you know, seeing the end of this? I fear that our conversation is not very reassuring. I think it's an important one this week, but I'm not sure it's an extremely reassuring one.
No, I think
apologize beforehand.
Yeah, sort of trigger warning. I think I was minded as we approached this milestone. You know, we knew obviously it was coming up. I, in my mind, thought, okay, this will be a chance for us to sort of step off the immediate news agenda. And not just us, actually. I thought kind of around the world, politicians, media people would be reflecting on the period of time. And particularly, I thought there might be some scope to go back to what happened on October the 7th. Now, we've talked a lot about how Israelis never left October the 7th. They're still in it. They're going over those events again and again and again. You know, it was restated to me recently, something that was said to me when I was there a few months back, which is, this isn't post-trauma, we're still in the trauma. But I thought that that would go a little bit further beyond Israel this week, in the sense that, you know, media outlets and others would do something kind of retrospective about the day this all started, and that we would too. As it happens, that was entirely sort of derailed by a huge event that could prove, and we get into it with Amos Harel later, but could prove critical in how the politics of this war plays out. And that is the three missile strike on a convoy of aid workers associated with working for the World Central Kitchen, a really beloved NGO that was feeding the hungry in Gaza. And seven aid workers were killed. That has dominated the news all over the world. And, you know, any prospect of talking about what happened on October 7th entirely shoved aside because people are focused on this event. It struck me as the details came through, if you had imagined a kind of simulation exercise where you have people sitting around thinking, what is the one thing we could do to make sure that Israel's already battered public image and reputation gets even worse? And you sort of war-gamed it out thinking, well, what if we were to hit not just any NGO, but one that's really loved, that indeed fed Israelis in the Gaza envelope following October the 7th, that has unbelievable connections in Washington, founded by a beloved TV chef who is a close friend of Joe Biden, that has workers from several of Israel's allies, you know, Poland, the US, the United Kingdom, three people, ex-veterans, doing, you know, who had complied with all the rules. They had submitted their route. They consulted with the IDF about their plan. And not just killed by one stray bullet, but in three different strikes, had to hit over a 2.5 kilometer period. You couldn't devise something that would have had more, could cause more damage, not only for those seven grieving families, obviously, but for how people are viewing Israel. And the proof of it I've seen this week, which is a whole lot of people who have right till now been the big defenders of Israel. You know, Joe Biden is the ultimate one, but just media figures in this country, former national security advisor served under Tony Blair and David Cameron saying no more arms sales to Israel. You know, Nick Ferrari is a broadcaster on a network here who is such a pro-Israel figure that he's the guy who hands out the awards at the and acts as master of ceremonies at Jewish charitable fundraising dinners in this country for Jewish care and Camp Simcha. He's on the radio saying no more arms to Israel. These are people who are not the usual suspects, I'm just stressing. These are Israel's, not just neutral, they're Israel's friends, and the Jewish community's friends, and they have said enough is enough.
Look, I have to tell you, the mood in this country after this happened was very, very, you know, dispirited. Israelis were upset about this, not only because of the ramifications that are clear that it looks like the game changer, but also just upset about this. As you said, this is an organization that fed Israelis inside Israel after October 7th. I feel the need to read to you something that journalist and foodie Ruti Russo wrote on Twitter. She wrote, I'm translating this into English. She wrote, "I'm crushed. The organization which helped us distribute 2 million hot meals in Israel during the war, feeding evacuees, is, and you know, she tells about what happened. She says, from what I know, their activity in Gaza is coordinated with the IDF. How does such a thing happen?" This is just her saying this on Twitter, but just the general mood of the country around this was, you know, it was like, as you said, this is really not something that is supposed to happen. We'll hear from Amos Harel in a few minutes that, you know, this wasn't, obviously this wasn't done deliberately. It looks like a terrible, terrible mistake, but, you know, this is not the kind of thing that should happen when Israel's already under tremendous pressure, again, by its friends to figure out what the end game is in this war in Gaza. This is what happens when a war is so prolonged that, you know, these kinds of mistakes happen.
The pressure, if you think about the political pressure on Joe Biden from his own side, you know, Democrats appalled by this and outraged by it. They want to see him doing something. And, you know, former US peace envoy Aaron David Miller wrote this week that so far America, Biden's approach has been kind of passive aggressive, he wrote, meaning it's been pretty passive in public, but pretty aggressive in private. Now the demand is for no more just sort of increased rhetoric from Tony Blinken and others, but action. And the action that is proposed is withholding of weapons, or, again, said to me by somebody well plugged in, a slow roll of weapon supplies, meaning that Biden doesn't say we're cutting off ammunition and guns and equipment to the Israelis, but instead we're going to slow walk it so it doesn't get there at the usual pace. This is a marked change in how the war is being conducted and could affect Israel's ability to fight it.
Definitely, and specifically if another front is opened up in the north. That is why you have seen such a sort of attempt at a swift response to what happened, an apology from the IDF chief of staff, from the IDF spokesperson's unit, from the prime minister himself, in fact, all trying to, you know, say Israel is sorry for this. I've heard voices in Washington saying, well, if you're very sorry, stop, just halt the activities in Gaza for 2 days to show more than just your apologies. Really tremendous anger at this incident. While Israel is still fighting a war that isn't over, in a response to the worst massacre in its history, we should say something about what is happening internally in Israel. What we have seen this week, and that is a flaring up. And essentially, I would say not only of the protests against the government, but also of some of the hostages' families really losing patience with what is going on. It has been 6 months. They know what their loved ones are going through. They are in hell and they want them out. And when you add together all of this, the fact that you're already hearing testimonies of hostages coming back and the sexual assault that they went through, Amit Sosana speaking with the New York Times and Stella and I speaking on Channel 12, and you realize that this is what is going on. You add to that the Knesset, we should say, many Israelis feel in an obtuse way, deciding to go to recess, even though the war is going on. Officially, it should be in recess, but come on, nothing is normal in this year. All of that adding up to frustration, anger, a lot of the hostages' families sort of stepping up their protests or protesting at all. You know, Netanyahu supporters saying these protests are all maneuvered by the people who actually protested against the government throughout the year. It doesn't matter. It feels like they are losing. Many people are losing patience with what is going on. The way that the government is running this war. This adds to a lot of the pressure. You talked a lot about the external pressure. This is the internal pressure going on right now in this country.
Yeah, and we all are always keeping an eye on the life expectancy of this coalition. And we will have noticed that in the war cabinet, the new, you know, outside entrance, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot from what had been the opposition party. Benny Gantz this week saying he thinks elections should be in September, which would mean allowing for the 3-month election campaign that the Knesset would be, or this government would dissolve in effect in June, or the election campaign would begin then. Others saying that is not soon enough. It needs to happen now. But at least a straw in the wind, a sign from Benny Gantz that, you know, he is gearing up to going. There are others, I would count myself among them, who think he has no business sitting next to Netanyahu in that war cabinet and should have walked some time ago. But the domestic pressure is bubbling, and how long Israelis are prepared to let the leadership that was in place on October 7th continue to be in charge, even as the possibility of a widening war grows. And you mentioned, obviously, that huge event, the assassination in Damascus. So we're going to get into all of these things. As we say, we're doing a different and kind of special episode, hearing three voices breaking down each of these different aspects of this war that has now gone on for 6 months.
Yes, and the first person we want to talk to is no stranger to this podcast, someone very, I think, well-positioned to answer a whole lot of our questions about where we are and where we're going.
Six months into the war, we wanted to talk to someone who has been following it every hour of every day since October the 7th and following it in an enlightening way for everyone else. Amos Harel of Haaretz has long been trusted as the preeminent Israeli military analyst. He's also an enduring friend of the podcast. Amos, it's very good to be back with you.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Look, obviously, we're going to talk about what this six-month milestone means, all that's happened. We want the big picture. But right now, at this moment, attention, especially around the world, focuses on these killings of 7 aid workers with World Central Kitchen, which has jolted even some of Israel's most staunch allies, politically, legally, in the media, all those kinds of people. The official view is that this was an honest, if dreadful, mistake. But I noticed that you have written that it does point to a wider problem, one that suggests there's a kind of discipline issue in the IDF. You write in your column published today as we speak, it's clear the incident is a symptom of a broader phenomenon, a light hand on the trigger when it comes to shooting near civilians. You go on to say the IDF suffers from a serious discipline problem in Gaza, frequent violations of its open fire policy, many violations of the laws of war. And you go on. I mean, is there a situation now where commanders on the ground are departing from the orders, the rules of engagement set out by those at the top?
I think to some extent, yes. And I think it's almost inevitable when you think of a long war, which would go on perhaps for many more months, with no decisive victory for the Israeli side. Once you're there for such a long period of time, and the soldiers are probably facing attrition and boredom and fear, and the enemy cannot be seen most of the time. This is the way guerrilla or terrorist organizations operate, especially on their home turf. They appear above ground for a very brief moment, launch an RPG rocket, try something else, sniper fire, and disappear immediately through a tunnel shaft. So I'm not really surprised that these things happen. It doesn't mean that they're justified. It doesn't mean that the IDF doesn't have to make sure that similar incidents don't reoccur. But it's almost understandable to anyone who follows that kind of wars to assume that things like this very regrettable incident can happen under these circumstances.
It seems like there, in every sort of lengthy Israeli operation, there's always something that happens that shouldn't happen, shouldn't have happened. And I wonder how much you think this really deeply regrettable incident is a game changer in the war in Gaza.
Look, Yonit, it's the nature of wars, and especially the nature of asymmetric wars. And Hamas doesn't need to apologize when it kills civilians. It never says it was by mistake, and it's not faced with any kind of questions over that. But when you talk of similar events happening, these were similar wars. Israel versus Hezbollah in 2006, Operation Grapes of Wrath in 1996 in Lebanon, similar incidents. I think it is a game changer. I think we should go back to late February, that incident where more than 100 Palestinians were killed around a convoy of trucks bringing food to northern Gaza Strip. Again, at that time, it's doubtful whether the IDF was responsible for most of the deaths. There was some shooting going on, but it was not extensive. And yet, this was the watershed moment in which the Biden administration changed its tune regarding the Israeli actions. Now it's even worse than that, because in the end, this is a very popular organization. It's well known in the Beltway around Washington. President Biden himself yesterday took two strategic phone calls. One was to the Chinese leader and the other to the head of this organization. These are Biden donors who are angry about this incident. So it's a big deal for the Americans. But when Jonathan mentioned in the beginning that this was the headline news, it's no longer such a big deal for Israeli media or the Israeli public. They're now more concerned about the possibility of a retaliation strike from Iran. And this is, it goes to show what kind of gap there is between Israel and the international community regarding the way the war is going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that Yoni and I talk about a lot, the disconnect between how this war seems from inside and outside. And this is such a good illustration of it, because this is huge around the world. Just on the point about how these things can happen, the thing that people are really stuck on is that it wasn't just one, as it were, stray bullet. There were three strikes over an area of nearly 2.5 kilometers, each strike hitting a vehicle directly. So the head of the organization, who is, you know, a buddy of Joe Biden, is saying this was targeted killing. And he says, actually, it was systematic. The chef, Jose Andres. I know there's an investigation, but you know these things better than most. What can have happened to lead it to be like that? Because one stray bullet you can sort of get your head around, but the idea of it being fire, then again another fire, then another, each time hitting the vehicle, makes it feel, even though they had shared their coordinates with the planners, they followed the route as set out, people are, you know, baffled as to how this came about.
I don't know, have the full details yet. I find it hard to believe that somebody on the Israeli side did that intentionally, knowing that these were aid workers, foreign aid workers, and that somebody decided to kill those guys because they felt like it. I don't think it's only a matter of coordination or lack of coordination. It's a matter of complete miscommunication between the Israeli army and that convoy. Again, we'll know more when the army shows its when it shares the details of its investigation with us. And yet, as you said in the beginning, I think it goes to show something more problematic going on. It goes back to this lack of interest from the Israeli side regarding casualties, civilian casualties. And we both know that if those workers had been Palestinians and not came from Poland and Australia and the UK and the US, there would have been less of an international fuss regarding that. And we wouldn't have the chief of staff, the Israeli chief of staff, apologizing on TV for what had happened. This goes back to the beginning of the war, the horrific atrocities of October 7th, the Israeli response, and the feeling right now that what matters more than anything else is killing Hamas and bringing back the hostages. Now, I can't put myself in the shoes of those officers who decided on the strike, but I would assume that they're under pressure for two different goals. One is to prevent attacks on Israeli soldiers, because every soldier's death is a big deal for the Israeli public and gets discussed in the media and so on. And there's a discussion, what point is there to continue the war and so on. And the second would be to kill more gunmen. There's a lot of fixation, even borderline obsession, I'd say, with the body counts, counting how many armed Hamas members, terrorists we've killed already, how many are still active, and so on. You see all kinds of assessments. Defense Minister Gallant, for instance, keeps giving all kinds of numbers. He assumes that more than 10,000 Hamas members have been killed, perhaps 10,000 more have been injured, and so on. Now, if you need to show results and you need to show more bodies, it's not that you go on intentionally killing civilians, but you're quite keen on capturing the enemy. And apparently there was a gunman around that convoy. They should have known that there were trucks there on the one hand, bringing food, and also the pickup trucks, the smaller pickup trucks in which the organization members were driving. The fact that somebody was seen there with a gun doesn't mean that this is a Hamas convoy. And somebody in the IDF needed to check who were the people in that convoy. But I think many similar mistakes were probably made under these circumstances, during the war. The fact that the casualties were Palestinian and not citizens of European countries or Western countries meant that there was much less interest in the international community and in the media regarding that.
Also, I assume a lot of instances of friendly fire because of the way the war is waged.
The IDF hasn't published the full statistics, but every time you talk to commanders, I would say probably 20-25% of deaths and injuries were actually from friendly fire. And this is because only because of lack of discipline, but because of the nature of this war. The fact that the area is so densely populated that we're fighting urban warfare for a long time. And in the beginning, you have to remember the number of troops there. There were 26 or 27 different brigades acting in Gaza. Now we only have four. So there's less fighting going on. It could be called warfare and not a war anymore. But mostly the fact that this was so densely populated and that you had units, you had one brigade on one street of a refugee camp and another brigade acting on another, meant that there were many, many incidents of mistaken identity or friendly fire and so on.
And just before we leave this topic, just on that very specific narrow point of guidance from the top, orders from the top, and commanders on the ground, there being a disconnect between them. Is that your impression?
To some extent, yes. I think it goes on in every kind of war. War is a mess. It's an area where chaos rules. Mm-hmm. And many mistakes are made, and people don't sleep well, people don't eat well, people are under extreme tension, anxiety, and so on. And mistakes are made. To expect that that Israel would not kill innocent civilians, this doesn't happen. This is the way wars are going. There's an ongoing debate. Look, for instance, you have Colonel John Spencer from the Marines from West Point, who keeps supporting the Israeli position and claiming that no other Western army took the same kind of measures that the Israelis have taken in Gaza in order to prevent killing of civilians. On the other hand, you have other American and Western experts who are saying, no, Israel is actually retaliating here. There's a lot of revenge going on. Israel is too aggressive, and perhaps NATO armies would have behaved differently. I'm not objective to begin with. I can't rule for sure who is right about this, but it's a very, very complicated matter. And the longer the war goes on, there's more of a chance that these incidents would repeat themselves.
You know, almost before Netanyahu began talking about total victory, the goals of the war were pretty clear here. It was dismantle Hamas as a fighting force, prevent it from ruling the Gaza Strip. Just on that, where are we 6 months on? Have we made a lot of progress?
We've made some progress, but I think even in the beginning, it was quite clear that this defined goal of annihilating the Hamas regime and dismantling all Hamas capabilities, whether it's governmental or military capabilities, this was quite setting the bar quite high, especially when you didn't talk of a timeline. You didn't have a time frame to what we were planning to do. And I have to remind you that only after Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot joined the war cabinet in the end of the first week of the war, there was another goal added to the defined goals of the campaign, which was creating the conditions which would help return all the hostages. Now, has Israel defeated Hamas? Not completely. Whenever there was a battle, and Jonathan, this may remind you of the history of Vietnam as well, whenever there was a battle between Israeli forces and Hamas terrorists, it was quite clear that the Israeli unit, whether it was a battalion or a brigade or a division, had the upper hand. There's no Hamas force or any force, I think, in the region which actually could stop an Israeli brigade once it starts driving towards its goal. The problem is holding the ground later on, searching it, and destroying the enemy. And there, of course, Hamas has the advantage of being in the home terrain. More than anything else, it's about the fact that Hamas has dug all those tunnels that had changed the face of the war completely. No other army, and here Colonel Spencer is actually absolutely right, no other army has faced such a challenge in the past. The fact that the civilians are above ground and that the terrorists, the fighters are intentionally underground makes it much more difficult to defeat them or to reach a decisive victory. So has Hamas been hurt to a significant extent? Yes. Has Hamas lost, presumably, between a quarter and perhaps a third of its fighters? Yes. But again, this is a guerrilla organization. They began as an army with brigades and battalions. Now they operate as terrorist cells. Three, four, five people with an RPG launcher and a video camera, which is the most important thing, or a cell phone to film it. And that's it for them. As long as they remain standing, then for them, they have won the war. It's not that the Palestinians in Gaza have won the war. It's quite clear that the Palestinian people have lost it on October 8th or 9th. But for Sinwar, I don't think that's very, very important for Hamas's leader.
I mean, given that they just, as it were, even if there's one Hamas man still standing, they're winners. Does it mean that this, and I'm struck by your invocation of Vietnam, the key thing people know about that is, yes, huge numbers of dead, but also just how long it went on. And you wrote earlier this week this phrase, the forever war. I wonder sometimes, here we are marking 6 months as if 6 months is a very long time. You know, the Americans stayed in Afghanistan for 20 years. Is this just going to be a war that goes on and on and on?
I hope not, but I think there's one distinction that should be made between our war and American wars, which is this is happening next door. To begin with, if you go back to October 7th, before that, even the right wing in Israel, who despised them, at least the ideological right wingers who despised Hamas and so on, most of them did not recommend a full occupation of the Gaza Strip. Some were dreaming secretly about building new settlements there. But most people said, okay, we'd live with them in some kind of a situation. And every now and then we'll have to hit them hard in order to prevent them from invading us. The shock of October 7th meant that suddenly the consensus in Israel was that we cannot live like that any longer. That since this is happening 1,000 yards away from Kfar Aza, from Kibbutz Kfar Aza, or 3 miles from Kibbutz Be'eri, and those communities were destroyed in a sort of an almost Nazi kind of way on October 7th, we could no longer coexist with this enemy. And this is the difference. And yet, once you face the actual reality, you realize that it's very, very hard to defeat such an organization. I think it's impossible to defeat the idea, the ideology. It is possible, in a way, to limit their capabilities, to hit them hard, to make them suffer, and so on. Would this mean that Hamas, at one point or another, would surrender, raise a white flag? I don't think so. Look back to Guardian of the Walls. That was the operation in May 21. That was the first time that Sinwar and his colleague, so to speak, Mohammed Def, tried a different operational plan. And when that war ended after 10 or 11 days, and Israel only had airstrikes, it didn't send in the ground troops, Israel declared victory. Israeli leaders, including Netanyahu and the army chief of staff, said that Hamas is now weakened and deterred. And all Sinwar did was, got himself filmed at his office, at the remains, at the relics of his office, if you'd like, sitting on a sofa. But that was the message. I'm still standing or sitting. I'm here. You come and find me if you'd like. And Israel did not. And Netanyahu didn't have the support of the Israeli people to go into Gaza and to assassinate Sinwar and to start a new war and to occupy the Gaza Strip. This wasn't the case.
I mean, there's so much more to go into that sort of six-month mark, but we have to say that what Israelis, we're talking on a Thursday, what Israelis are sort of even on the verge of obsessing about is the possible Iranian response to the assassination on Monday of Mohammad Reza Zahedi, not just another assassination, we should say a senior military commander in the IRGC. Could you go into that decision-making in Israel? On the one hand, saying this is a major target, we have an opportunity, but on the other hand, knowing what kind of response Iran might be preparing for Israel, and how imminent is that response, in your opinion?
The response is quite imminent. And the point here, as far as I can gather right now, and I don't have the full information yet, I hope to get it in the future, I'm not sure that this was thought about in the way that it needed to be dealt with. My suspicion is that they're quite surprised by the public threats and the public response from Tehran, because in the past, we've seen not exactly the same attacks, but quite similar attacks. There was the Soleimani assassination. This was an American operation, but apparently the Israelis helped with intelligence. That was January 2020. A few months later, Fakhrizadeh, a professor who was ahead of their nuclear plan, again, assassinated presumably by Israel near Tehran. There were other incidents as well. And we always heard threats, but it was quite clear that the Iranians were cautious and careful not to bring this to the next level and to avoid a full-scale war. Now, ever since the attack happened, and Israel didn't claim responsibility, although four Israeli officials, different officials, told the New York Times that it was us behind it. Anyway, the Iranians are quite clear right now that there will be retaliation. They're sending signals or hints that it's going to be an Iranian retaliation and not through their proxy forces in Hezbollah or the Shiite militias in Iraq. And therefore, there's some expectation that within the next 24 or 48 hours, there will be an attack on Israeli soil from Iran, which is something that we haven't seen before. How serious that can be, I don't know. It could be, sending a few cruise missiles or a few attack drones and trying to go for some Israeli infrastructure site. Would this necessarily mean that they're going to shoot missiles at Tel Aviv? That's quite a gamble to take for the Iranians. And it's quite clear that they're not interested in full-scale war and that they still fear the American response. But if we go back to what we discussed earlier, then the fact that there's such a crisis between Biden and Netanyahu and the fact that it's so clear that the president can no longer stand even talking to Netanyahu, although they are supposed to talk on the phone briefly later on today, how much support do we actually have from the Americans under these new circumstances? I still think that if Iran would launch a big attack, a massive attack, Washington would stand by us, would support us and do what needs to be done. And yet, this is this is uncharted territory. This is very different than what we've encountered before. My guess is that the Israelis were taken by surprise. There was an operational chance here to hit somebody who's important, who helped kill many Israeli citizens in the past, who's behind all this weapon smuggling for Hezbollah for many years. And once they had him as a target, a decision was taken. Was that thought through? Did somebody discuss the possible implications? Did they look back at the history of assassinations? Some assassinations are quite effective. If you look back to Fathi Shkaki, the leader of Islamic Jihad, 95 in Malta, presumably assassinated by Mossad, the general line of thinking is that the Islamic Jihad was out of the picture for 5 or 6 years. That's important. If you look back to assassinations of Hamas leaders in the middle of the Second Intifada, Sheikh Yassin, Dr. Rantisi, and others, 2003 to 2005, in some way, it contributed to Hamas's decision to pull back from the Second Intifada and to stop sending suicide bombers to Israel. So this was significant. This time, is that enough to deter Iran? Now, I'm already anticipating Jonathan's next question. Was this done intentionally to bring the region into war? I don't think so. My guess, and it's only a guess right now, is that Israel assumed that if we hit Iran hard enough, then since the mullahs would get their fingers burned for the first time, they'll be more careful and perhaps will restrain Hezbollah attacks. And yet, at this moment, as we speak, and we're still anticipating a possible attack, there's a fear that we got it wrong, that we misunderstood where the Iranians were heading on this.
Well, you're right. That's what I was thinking about, the war in the north. And you said there that the attack, the response, if it comes, it's expected it will be direct from Iran rather than through a proxy. Nevertheless, Hezbollah in the north, in Lebanon, are obviously connected with this. It's been one of the sort of riddles, puzzles of the conflict so far that, you know, that they didn't join in on October the 8th, that maybe it was part of Sinwar's calculation that they would, and that Israel would be attacked under attack from both the south and the north. They didn't. They held back. You know, what's the calculation there about when and if they get involved? And also, you do point, you know, you mentioned my thought about whether this was deliberate. The incentive structure for Netanyahu particularly, if he, for reasons we've talked about a lot on the podcast, about wanting to put off the day of reckoning from either the election or a commission of inquiry, he has some incentive for this war to go on and on. Is it completely spurious to imagine that he wants an escalation? Or do you come across in your conversations with IDF planners and other people that they believe the man in charge actually has a motivation to see this war widen?
Okay, so let's divide this into the two different matters you raised. One regarding Hezbollah, where are they heading? It's now clearer, a bit clearer, what happened on October 7th. Sinwar did discuss his plans with his masters in Tehran and with Hezbollah, but he surprised them by choosing the timing and not telling them in advance. I would assume that most of this was done because he needed to keep this a secret from the Israelis, but they were surprised. And it was, I think Khamenei, the supreme leader from Iran, was actually quoted later on at Reuters saying something along the lines of, Once Hamas decided to strike on its own, it was on its own, and Iran was not going to take part in this. They did start launching rockets by Hezbollah and some Islamist Palestinian groups from Lebanon on October 8th. That meant that Israel had to deploy three different reserve divisions there, and that a lot of force was focused on the northern border while Israel was planning for the attack against Hamas in Gaza. It's quite clear that Sinwar is not satisfied by this, but there's some level of coordination going on. Until recently, at least, the general line of thinking in Tel Aviv was that neither Hezbollah or the leaders in Tehran were looking for a full-scale conflict. This "don't" speech by Biden on October 10th still has an influence over their decision-making. Will this change after the recent assassination? We don't know yet. And by the time this is broadcasted, I may sound like a fool. So I'll be careful about any kind of assessment.
Always
now, back to always a good tactic.
No, I said always a bigger chance we'll sound like fools than you. So don't worry about that.
Okay. So the second question regarding Netanyahu. Look, I'm very suspicious of Netanyahu for a long time. And one thing I know, I'd almost say for sure now, which is different than what I thought about him before, is that his own political and personal interest is much higher on his agenda right now than the safety of my family or Yonit's family. It's no longer an issue. He's fighting for his political and personal survival. He wants to stay out of jail, like this card you get in the Monopoly games, and this is what he's up to. Would this mean that he would, you know, take an approach of by any means necessary? I don't know yet. And going all the way against Hezbollah in Iran, with America warning us exactly not to do that, that's quite stretching it. That's a bit far-fetched. I don't think that's the case anymore yet. But I do have to say that most of the security apparatus leaders in Israel are more and more suspicious of his intentions and do not take him at face value. The best example, of course, are all these empty promises of, on the one hand, decisive victory, we'll fight until the decisive victory, which is, again, for a democratic leader, it sounds a bit strange. And all those promises about Rafah. It's quite clear that Rafah is not happening anytime soon. It may happen in the future, but the American reservations about that have been made public. And yet every two or three days, he makes this promise, we will go into Rafah, and he makes it sound as if it would happen soon. It won't happen soon. It will take a month or two or three. And even then, I'm not sure that it would actually be implemented in the end.
We're talking post the assassination. Before this assassination happened, the sort of, I guess, common sense was we will have a hostage deal that will lead to some sort of cessation in Gaza that might lead to an agreement of sorts with Hezbollah in the north, and the whole thing will quiet down a little bit. So my question is that in any way still on the table, and where are we vis-a-vis the chances of a hostage deal?
Okay, the two parts of my answer will contradict each other.
It's the Jewish way, Amos.
Yeah. Look, it's not off the table. There's still a possibility for this to happen. And if it does, in my view, under the extreme circumstances we're stuck in, it's probably the best case scenario. Yes, at one point or another, Israel would make some more concessions, perhaps Hamas as well. Many hostages' lives would be saved. There will be a ceasefire for a certain amount of time. The fighting may continue later on. And the Americans, especially Amos Hochstein, Biden's envoy to the region, would try to use that period of time, presumably 6 weeks, to reach a similar ceasefire up north. And maybe we could get our residents back to their homes in the communities across the Lebanese border. 60,000 Israelis who are still refugees. They haven't come back yet, unlike the situation in the north, in the south, where some people from the Gaza envelope are back in their homes. So this is still a possibility. On the other hand, I would recommend to take all those reports that we hear mostly from recently from Israeli diplomatic sources about some kind of progress being made in recent days. I will take that with a grain of salt. It's actually Netanyahu's interest right now to spread good news or optimistic assessments because he's trying to contain the biggest threat for him, which is the hostages' protests, which have become much more emotional and aggressive in recent days. And again, going back to by any means necessary, this means misleading the press quite a lot. There will be a positive sign if we hear that the chiefs of Mossad and Shin Bet and the army's POW center, General Nitzan Alon, if all those three officers go back to Doha in Qatar or Cairo for discussions, we will know that this is more serious. As long as this is defined as technical negotiations, we're not there yet.
Amos, you wrote a piece for Haaretz to mark the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War in October of last year. And in fact, it was published just 2 weeks before October the 7th. The headline was, "The next surprise will come. The question is, how is Israel preparing for it? Which is quite chilling to read the sort of prescience of that question. So two things flow from that. One, we now know what that surprise was. How well prepared was Israel for that? And the second thing is the change since then. At the time, mainly, governments around the world supported Israel. Now, Israel is looking pretty isolated. What do you think, if you had to point to one thing, accounts for that change?
Well, it's very clear that we were ill prepared. No nation, no army can claim it was prepared for something like this if it ends in a fiasco with 1,200 people dead, murdered, and 250 Israelis kidnapped by Hamas. This is not a great success, and this shouldn't have happened in any way. We live in a very difficult region. We need to be prepared, and it's quite clear that everybody from Netanyahu, who refuses to take any kind of responsibility to what happened, to the division commanders and the brigade commanders and the chiefs of the IDF and Shin Bet and so on, is everybody has a part and should be blamed in what has happened. Look, I think the rules are against us, so to speak, to begin with. The game is fixed in a way. Even the sentiment we had on October 7th, we had received, not everybody shared it. And the Palestinians can have it both ways. They can celebrate their so-called victory on October 7th and then deny any kind of atrocities going on. Look at something we've discussed, all three of us, in the past quite intensively, which are the sex crimes. The Palestinians don't admit any of this, and it's hard even to persuade liberals in the West that this actually happened. Well, it's very, very clear that all of those atrocities, nobody has imagined them. They happened. They're reality. So I think in a way, and I won't get into the Hasbara wars and so on, I think there's a certain bias towards Israeli actions anyway. And it was very clear that once we started retaliating and we sent in the ground troops and so on, and in order to defend those troops, we had to act in quite an aggressive way, the outcome would, you know, you could have foreseen that coming from a long way. But on top of this, we have this very peculiar leadership, which Netanyahu presents right now. His refusal, I don't think it's ideological, I think it's political, to discuss the day after. That's the biggest deal here. He went to some, you know, to some level, he did accept some of Biden's demands regarding humanitarian assistance. Israel failed miserably in recent weeks, but the decision to answer in a positive way the American demands a month or two ago means that Netanyahu understood that perfectly. But the refusal to discuss the day after, look, we're 6 months into a war with no strategic goals apart from defeating them and reaching a decisive victory. And whenever I went to Washington twice, and I had a lot of discussions with European diplomats and so on, some officers and so on, it's quite clear that they have an expectation to see an exit strategy of Israel presenting some kind of a future for the region. Now, it's true, Gaza is a hellhole. It's the worst place in the region right now. People are suffering for many reasons. It's very, very hard to come out with a positive scenario from a sort of a liberal Western perspective. We won't all live happily ever after. And a lot of people are dying, of course. And it will take time, and it will be very, very hard. I think the Americans are in a way misleading themselves and the world, assuming that Hamas could somehow be taken out of the picture without being defeated on a military level, and that somehow the Palestinian Authority could step in their shoes and everything would be rosy. It's not going to happen. So the reality itself is quite complicated. And yet the complete refusal to deal with any kind of a positive scenario, you know, it's an own goal. We're shooting ourselves in the leg, and it's quite clear that this is what's happening for a very long time.
Amos Harel, we always feel smarter talking to you. I can't say reassured and optimistic, sadly, but definitely smarter.
This isn't part of the bargain, you
know? Yeah, yeah. The geography sort of dictates that. Amos Harel, thank you. Thanks again for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Always really valuable hearing from Amos Harel. So many interesting insights there, including that one that he has been writing about, that there is this disconnect in terms of orders from the top are not necessarily feeding through all the way to those people making the decisions on the ground. And maybe that played a role in this huge event this week in terms of the aid convoy.
Yes, it also struck me what he said about that decision to assassinate Zahedi, the top Al-Quds Brigade Iranian sitting in Damascus, responsible for Damascus and for Syria and for Lebanon, the connection with Hezbollah, and saying that he's not sure it was well thought out by the Israeli leadership. Now, we're sitting here on Thursday when everyone is expecting an imminent response by the Iranians against Israel, you know, on Friday, and we hear this, you know, the top military analyst of the country saying maybe this wasn't well thought out by the leadership. That's concerning. You know, that is where we are at this point. It's a worrying thought.
You put these three things together: the discipline issue he highlighted, the not being thought through, and then the failures of that led to October 7th itself. Altogether, it suggests a security and political echelon that is not as fully on top of things as I think people would have expected and did assume of Israel. These are, you know, the idea they can make a big decision like that and not really think through the implications is a bit shocking. As we've said, all the way through this, and in fact, all the way through doing this podcast, we've always looked at how these two things, Israel and the Jewish world outside Israel, interact with each other, the bond between them, complicated, messy as that bond is. And in a way, it's never been stronger, is what I was going to say, than these last 6 months. I mean, albeit with, you know, consequences that are really difficult for everyone involved, but a lot of people have been reminded of, quite Jewish people, have been reminded of how bound up they are one way or another with what happens in Israel, even people who didn't know that they thought that. And for a long while, you and I have wanted to speak to our next guest because she has a very particular and very unique perspective, not just in terms of the Jewish community or one of the biggest diaspora Jewish community, namely in the United States, but also because she brings to it a kind of thoughtful, even dare I say it, spiritual dimension. So let's speak to her.
Rabbi Angela Buchdel is, according to Newsweek magazine, one of America's 50 most influential rabbis. She's the senior rabbi of Central Synagogue in New York City and the first woman to lead the Central's Reform Congregation in its 180, I think even more, year history. Rabbi Angela, thank you so much for talking to us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
First of all, a rabbi, even on a normal day, needs to be the source of strength and resilience for the community. How do you do that these days when you know, everything is anything but normal?
These are definitely not normal times. And I feel like so much of my job is to help people maintain a sense of balance and groundedness and calm. But if you take someone who's feeling anxious and calm, I think you all know that the least helpful thing to do is to say, calm down or don't be afraid, right? That never works. And I think what we learn from Judaism is that instead of it being a directive, there are actually tools that we have that help us calm down, feel grounded, and move forward in a time of tremendous stress. I mean, the unfortunate thing is, I guess the first thing we remind ourselves is that Jews, we've been here before. We know war, we know pogroms, we know anti-Semitism, we even know enslavement. And you know, I'll just share three strategies that our people have used over time that I think it's important to remember that we've not only been here before, but we've moved past these before with this. So if we go to maybe one of the worst moments in our people's time ever, the destruction of the temple, when we thought our entire Judaism was over, what did our people say? They said that we were so polarized and fighting each other in the worst ways that we the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Hinam, baseless hatred. It might look a little bit like what Israel looked like on October 6th, honestly. And what did they do? They say, Rabbi Yochanan said, okay, we can't give sacrifices anymore. We're going to do Gemilut Chasadim. And I think one of the most beautiful things is my first visit to Israel after October 7th, I saw Israelis doing unbelievable acts of generosity and kindness, cooking for each other, volunteering, doing each other's laundry, babysitting, couldn't do enough. And what you saw is that it not only strengthened those who were, you know, refugees in that moment or hostage families or people with husbands in Miluim, it was also healing them. So I guess the first strategy that our people has always known is that in these moments, in a world that is destroyed by hate, we can build it and heal it with love and acts of kindness. So doing things for others is one of the surefire ways to pull ourselves out of our, you know, our inward focus that sometimes can oppress us in our own way. The second thing I'd say is Judaism already, a long, long time ago, gave us the most powerful spiritual technology of liberation that ever existed, which is Shabbat. And I think that Jews forget that. But what's been very interesting is we have never been more full at Shabbat at Central Synagogue. And I know that that's not a unique story. We are literally 800, 900 people every Friday night since October 7th. And I know that synagogues around the country, I don't know if this is the case in Israel, but certainly here, people are really needing Shabbat. And it is a way that we build our own spiritual resilience for the work of the week. Like the rest of the days, we are fighting anti-Semitism, fighting the media war, worrying about Israel and a true war. Many people are actually fighting in that war. But one day a week, we actually need to understand the world and be in the world as it's in a moment where it's perfect and not actually needing everything else. And I can't even tell you how much I've only survived these months because of Shabbat and actually taking Shabbat. The third last one I would just offer is, you know, the many teachers in our history have shared this, but maybe the most beautifully came from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, that maybe the primary religious stance we need to come from, especially in moments of tension and pain and oppression, is wonder and awe. And recently there've been a lot of scientific studies that help us understand how awe operates in us. But, when we experience awe, we actually feel not only less self-focused and more understanding that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. It makes us more generous, more connected to other people, more selfless, all the things that you want a religious person, a spiritual person to feel, you feel from awe. You can listen to a great piece of music, a symphony, or go out and walk in nature, things that inspire awe and wonder. But rather than just say, calm down, be okay, our tradition has given us strategies. Do acts for others and gemilut chasadim. Make a Shabbat for yourself every week. Go and find actively wonder and awe in your world. That to me, these are the strategies that I think our tradition has taught us that we have never needed more.
I want to go back to the big turnout in your synagogue and in other synagogues on a Friday night, Shabbat morning. I want to hear what you think people are going there for and whether this big moment, because it happened after October 7th, whether that was the feeling that was driving people back to want to be in a room with other Jews, was about Israel and solidarity and the feeling they have for their fellow Jews in Israel, or was it about themselves? And in the months that have followed since October 7th, a sense of needing kind of security in numbers because of the fear they feel about themselves. And I'm talking there about rising anti-Semitism. So I'm interested to know what your impression of what your community is needing shelter from, in a way.
In the early weeks, I think that people just needed to be with other Jews. Like I heard from many people, I only want to socialize with Jews right now. Because honestly, it felt scary to be at a dinner party with people who weren't Jewish in the beginning, because it was so hard to talk about what was going on, or you felt that it was all you wanted to talk about and people who weren't Jewish were just not processing it in the same way. So I think that in the beginning, it was a deep need to be around other people and to get the comfort of a community that was, and I would say that in those first 2 months, let's say, I've never felt my community more aligned and on the same page on Israel. Just so you know, I have an incredibly diverse community where every Israel sermon I've ever gotten, I get like a critique on both sides. Which generally means that I'm probably hitting it in the right place, I think, just because of the way my community operates. But for a blessed couple months, I felt like, oh my God, we are all together in this. And there was something very powerful about that feeling, especially because in the rest of the world, it felt so different. But I think people are coming back now, 6 months later, because it's not just about feeling of protection or comfort. I think there's also a sense of joy and hopefulness and spiritual sustenance that comes, a sense that you are connected to this bigger community. I think that people forgot that some of the rituals of singing with other people, I know that sounds crazy, but we don't do communal singing anymore in most spaces in our lives. something happens when you collectively pray and sing together that makes you feel better, different, connected afterward. And people are desperate for those things that you actually are not finding anywhere else but in worship and in synagogue.
I really want to ask more about the, you know, how careful or not you want to be about Israel, but I'm pulling on the diaspora part of our conversation before we get into, you know, the Israeli self-involvement. And I kind of want to ask, I remember I was in Central Synagogue. We met in 2019. The security was already pretty heightened then. I kind of want to hear from you just, you know, how concerned you are, how concerned the congregation is. How does that, how worried you are of this wave of anti-Semitism?
Oh, we're definitely worried about it. I'm definitely worried. And I'm not the kind of person who's generally, you know, a particularly worried kind of person, but I feel it. I mean, I think that there are real dangers, and you would be naive if you didn't protect yourselves against them. You know, my synagogue is a large synagogue in Midtown Manhattan, you know, kind of the center, I think, of the Jewish American universe. And so therefore we've, you know, had to do things like have a very advanced metal detectors, and we have armed guards that are both outside and inside the sanctuary every time we worship. I have a full-time director of security who is former New York Police Department counterterrorism head. That we spend nearly $1 million just my synagogue on security, which is a shame that that is what we have to do. But we must protect ourselves, and that's very real. And we do everything we can to make ourselves an incredibly hard target. I think that the security that people feel that it is not just physical, but is also just existential and social fear of just what it is to be ostracized or to be marginalized as a Jew. I think that that's very real and much harder to protect ourselves from. Our kids are feeling it on college campuses, of course. People who are in certain industries, from cultural organizations, NGOs, legal aid, arts organizations, these have been much, much harder spaces to be someone who is outwardly pro-Israel and a Zionist, and actually in some places very, very hostile. I don't know how we protect ourselves against that. I think that we have tried to educate people where we can, to build relationships where we can. But we're in a fraught time where there are lots of people who just aren't even willing to listen. And there is just a demonization, that kind of demonization is just outright anti-Semitism.
I'm thinking about where you are and, you know, being in New York City, and you said center of the one kind of Jewish world, but also actually in terms of progressive world and the art, those arts industries, et cetera, you talked about. You said it's hard to be, though those people are not sympathetic if you are pro-Israel or, you know, Zionist. I'm wondering how sympathetic they are to Jews and whether that you get any sympathy for the anti-Semitism you're describing and the need, for example, to have, you know, to spend a huge amount of resources on security. Whether in today's progressive New York, in this era that we're in now of identity politics, whether Jews are branded as oppressor rather than oppressed, and therefore you find yourself not actually, you know, ranked among the kind of minorities who deserve solidarity and, you know, protection from the kind of progressive politics that in some ways New York, you know, embodies in the world's imagination.
I want to emphasize that I think that there is a silent majority that's kind of firmly in the center here that are absolutely horrified by the anti-Semitism, supportive of Jews, you know, rational-minded. They might actually even want a ceasefire, but they're sympathetic to the anti-Semitism. They are actually, they want to see Hamas eradicated. Perhaps they just are, you know, struggling. I would say that there's a huge body of most people who are in that category. And I think of these as good people. I think that there is a small minority, but they're quite vocal, of people that I would say, you know, on the extremes. But if we were to talk about the sort of progressive left, there are definitely those who are on the extreme who have already made up their mind and demonized Israel and Jews who support Israel in such a way that even when the worst atrocities happen, it runs so counter to their victim-victimizer scenario or oppressed-oppressor binary that it is a cognitive dissonance that they cannot operate with. And so they literally deny the atrocities. I mean, I can't believe how many people that I think are educated people who will say, those rapes didn't really happen. That's like because they can't see someone that they see as the oppressor being actually oppressed in that way. They will, if things like the Holocaust come up or October 7th come up, there's impatience or a sense of you were using that to give yourself cover. You're pink washing. All the kind of ways that actually they will completely demean any of the actual hurt or oppression that Jews have experienced, and they see it as just a manipulation tool. So this is really gross, and that is a kind of a form of anti-Semitism altogether. I think that I recently learned about a major seminary where they train progressive Christian ministers, and they have really not behaved well around Israel. When they said, we're going to have a panel of different voices, their Jewish voice was Jewish Voices for Peace, which is a voice that is relatively marginal in the Jewish community. It is a voice, but it is certainly not a representative voice of the Jewish community. And that was the only Jewish voice they had, or any pro-Israel voice. When later a student who was there made complaints, a Jewish student, they said, okay, we're going to do multiple narratives. But in the end of the day, what they realized is they weren't even going to allow the Israeli narrative to be one of the multiple narratives. Now, I found that shocking and unbelievable irresponsible for a major seminary in America to behave that way. There was just a feeling that Israel is so illegitimate because it's a colonial settler oppressor that they don't even have the right to have a narrative in this. I don't even know how you begin to have a conversation with someone who thinks that way. That is the scariest.
Is the congregation itself now, you said at the beginning, everyone came together about Israel. Is it now divided somehow on this issue? And if it is it a generational thing?
I don't know that I could give you the exact numbers, but I would say that as the war wears on, there is greater and greater questioning among Jews who I think of as the vast majority as pro-Israel. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to really grapple with is that we're not talking about people who called for a ceasefire on October 8th. We're talking about people who were absolutely understanding and felt that this war was justified, who have been lifelong Zionists, but who are watching this war being led by a government that they absolutely do not trust, where they feel like Netanyahu has ulterior motives for keeping this war going. We could talk about all the reasons. I don't think that Israelis necessarily feel a lot differently than that. They're seeing very little description of what the day after looks like or how anything is rebuilt after you've radicalized an entire population in Gaza with a terrible war. And they're seeing literally pictures of starving children and pictures of dead babies. And I think that in America, we are seeing a lot more pictures than you're seeing in Israel. And I think that it's impossible as a human being to witness that and not to feel that somehow your heart wants to cry out and say, this has to stop. There has to be a way that this is going to stop. This has caused tension in the community. I can't tell you that it's divided half and half. I think that my community is still, generally speaking, pro-Israel. And I would say that many, many, many can no longer feel they can they want to see the war end. I mean, I don't know that they're all calling for a ceasefire. I don't think that they're all fighting against things. I think that people are deeply discomforted. We pray for the hostages every week. You know, since October 7th, we have said a prayer for the hostages literally every week. I don't think anyone is against us doing that. No one is troubled by that. We all should continue to pray for the hostages to come home. We actually offer a prayer for the state of Israel every single week, which asks for wisdom on the leaders and for a time that is a more peaceful time. No one is against that. I think that there is division, however, on, there are some who said, you should be pushing for us to, call for a ceasefire as a rabbi. That is not something I've done, but I think that this is what I'm hearing in my community much more.
Mm-hmm. I think you characterize that really well, because the divisions are not actually necessarily between people. They're often within people. The same person
absolutely
can feel
that's a beautiful
all these
way of putting
things,
it.
They can feel these things within them. Just an example of how toxic this can get, though, and we've all in our different areas of life have experienced some of this. Just last week, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, who's a sort of is, you know, well-known figure, I'm choosing my words carefully, said that you are suffering from, his words, moral confusion about Israel and Hamas. I don't want you to have to sort of get into a ding-dong with him, former spiritual guide to Michael Jackson. But I do wonder whether or not you feel there's, it's an instance, it's an illustration of how difficult this is becoming as a conversation, that people are now, not the ones we were describing who are caught between, you know, divided internally, but other people are in camps, polarized, and people are not willing to listen to each other.
I think that whenever you feel threatened, then any argument that kind of challenges your moral certainty in a moment can actually not just feel like it's different than the way you feel. It can feel threatening to your existence. And I think that we're, as a Jewish community, we are feeling that sense of threat, which makes even ideas that are different than ours feel threatening. And I just want to name that. And I have fallen prey to that myself. There are times when I'm hearing anti-Israel voices that have triggered me emotionally in ways that I've never felt before, because I do feel the threat of that. And so I would say in this case, I mean, I think Rabbi Boteach is in a particular category. I mean, I think I was the number of rabbis that I expect that I respect that called me after I was attacked by him made me realize I was part of a special club of rabbis that I really look up to who have also been attacked by Rabbi Boteach. So I'm going to put him in a particular camp of, I think, attracting certain attention by going after people. But unfortunately, the Times of Israel had a very irresponsible original reporting of this story with a headline that was absolutely misleading, and it did real damage. And it reminded me that that it's a hard time for holding multiple truths and for nuance, which is actually something that Jews have always done, and it's actually one of the gifts that I think the Jewish people has brought to the world, being able to say elu ve'elu for arguments that are for the sake of heaven, which I think is one that many of us are struggling with. I think that there are arguments within this that are outside the scope of heaven. I think they really are just to demonize. But I think that there are legitimately arguments here that we are struggling with, and that we need to be able to name for us to move forward, to maintain our humanity in a time that feels so inhumane. And so I stand by everything I said. It was misrepresented as I was saying that because I'm struggling with all of these things, I can no longer support Israel, which is absolutely not the case. I've never signed that letter for ceasefire. I have absolute clarity that Hamas has to take responsibility for those, so many of those civilian deaths, that because they've actually used civilians as a strategy in their war, and you know, helped make sure that aid doesn't actually get to the people who need it the most. So absolutely, Hamas is responsible. And I think the war would end tomorrow if they gave back the hostages and said, we're not going to attack Israel. So I don't think I have any problem understanding the responsibility of Hamas in this war. But I do think that we need to get back to understanding that we can hold truths that are difficult to reconcile and sometimes even feel at odds, and that we have to struggle with them.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I'm wondering, as we're sitting here 2.5 weeks before Erev Pesach, how do we sit at the table this year? How do we celebrate this year? How is that even possible?
I have already heard from many of my congregants that they're very worried about Passover this year. They're worried about their niece and their nephew or their children who feel so differently about Israel that some of them don't even want to come, let alone feeling like what the conversation's going to be, or their Uncle Maury, who is so right-wing, and then they can't have a conversation. I think that, listen, we're reminded we've been in Mitzrayim. We might be in a Mitzrayim right now, which is a narrow place. And Mitzrayim is obviously not just a physical location. It can be a mindset. And I think that many
you're
of us are
referring there to Egypt.
Right,
I'm just thinking of our listeners who are not steeped in this.
Yes.
You're referring to Egypt, the Mitzrayim, the word Egypt, but it also means a narrow place. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It literally means narrow place, but it is our Egypt, and it is both a physical and metaphorical place that we're in. I actually think that the Seder gives us the most amazing methodology. You know, the methodology of the educational and ritual experience of a Seder is to ask questions, as we know. It's all about asking questions. I'm very intrigued by the fact, though, that the kind of the quintessential four questions that we ask at a Seder, Manishtana HaLaila Hazeh, what makes this night different than other nights? Do you notice that the answer is not even really an answer? It says, on all other nights, one of them, all other nights we eat bread or matzah, but on this night only matzah. Now, that's not really an answer. That's kind of an answer to how it's different that we only eat matzah. But then, of course, it begs another question. But why matzah? And if you say matzah because we had to make matzah because we had to flee, but then why were we fleeing? What were we fleeing from? It should be that the methodology of a good Seder is that every question leads to another question. And I might encourage us as we think about the fraughtness of being in Mitzrayim, being in the narrow place with our family in a time where we are going to be telling a story of our enslavement and our oppression and coming out of narrow places and the possibility of redemption, then maybe the redemption comes and we can ask the question, not because we're listening to come back with an argument, but we're listening to actually understand and we're listening to ask the next question. You know, it's interesting that it could have been that the Seder could have been a moment of preaching. We have a lot of other holidays where we preach things. This is not the method of a Seder. So when you're at your Seder tables, instead of imagining that you're going to try to have to convince that niece or nephew or your child or that uncle that they're wrong about the way they feel about something, ask a question that helps you understand where they're coming from. It's called, I don't know, active, resilient listening. It's a real skill that we need to have. And don't listen to try to refute them, but to understand them. And when we do that, maybe that will just be the little taste of redemption that we all need right now.
Well, that is wonderful advice as we prepare for Pesach. Mm-hmm. I am going to ask a question, which is a potential candidate for our Chutzpah Award. I'm going to exercise a bit of cheek here. And that's because you said before that you gave us three bits of advice, and one of them was to expose ourselves to the feeling of awe, that we should do that and put ourselves in front of that opportunity. Now, I know, because I've heard you, that you have an awesome singing voice. And it instills me with awe when I hear you. And we have given in this episode quite a lot of gloomy thoughts about our situation. With Pesach approaching, perhaps, that could be something else. I wondered if, and we didn't plan this, so you can say no, because it's only spontaneously hit me, whether you would let our listeners have a feeling of awe and just for a few moments, perhaps give us something of song. But if you feel it's too much of an ambush, Rabbi Angela, then we'll understand.
What did Barbara Streisand say when she was asked? She was like, oh, I couldn't possibly. Okay, if you insist. All right, well, okay, just as long as your listeners know, I didn't prepare for this. I mean, I think that it's hard for me not to think of the very powerful call of our Seders, that every one of us in every generation has to remember that we personally came out of Egypt. And I think maybe that is one of the most powerful lessons. And maybe this year, we don't have to imagine it as much. Maybe we really feel it. But we have to feel not just the oppression, we have to feel the redemption. We have to feel what it feels like to walk out of that place. Because sometimes when you're in it, you cannot imagine that you can come out of it. I've heard over and over people say, I don't understand how we're going to come out of this time. How is Israel going to get past this moment? How are we as a Jewish people in America going to get past this moment? Jews wherever they are, and non-Jews. Like, I think we're in such a fraught time. We can't imagine the liberation. So I'm going to encourage us as we listen to this line from the Seder to imagine it. Bechol dor vador chayav adam lirot, lirot et atzmo ke'ilu yatsa mimitzrayim. May it be so.
Amen. Rabbi Angela Buchdahl teaching us that chutzpah is sometimes rewarded. That was a moment of zen, as John Stewart would say. That was a moment of beauty for what has been in some ways quite a bleak reflection on the 6 month anniversary. We are really grateful. Thank you for coming on Unholy.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad I asked is all I can say, because that was really, really worth it from her.
Jonathan Friedland, I'm so glad I did that. I mean, that was a great conversation. I think we were in desperate need of a little bit of guidance here throughout these 6 months. And I there's so many important things that Rabbi Angela said. One of them is the ability to hold a few truths in your head and a nuanced reality. And that definitely is needed in the world that we live in. At some point, I think I thought she was talking about our war therapy episode and the way that we were, in a way, that what can you do if you disagree, and what can you do around the Seder, Pesach Seder, if you find yourself disagreeing with a family member or a good friend, and sort of trying to be there and to listen and to ask and not to argue.
Yeah, and I think that thing about questions was really useful, actually, although we all know that I'm just picturing people grilling Uncle Maury, appearing to just say, I'm just asking questions, but, you know, we all know there can be such thing as sort of hostile interrogation. But nevertheless, I think the spirit of it absolutely helpful. We said at the top that we are getting different perspectives on this 6 month milestone. We've had the sort of military and political. I think that was a very enlightening spiritual perspective. But all the way through, obviously in the minds of Israelis and people around the world who care about them, has been the plight of those people taken hostage on October the 7th, many of whom remain captives. And we wanted to talk to somebody whose eye has been really focused on them from the beginning, and is particularly somebody whose eye has been on this from the beginning and really right up till now.
Bianca Golodryga is a CNN anchor and senior global affairs analyst. Her special report on the Israeli hostages returning home will air this Sunday, the 6 month mark on the whole story with Anderson Cooper. Bianca, thank you so much for talking to us on Unholy.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you. I think you both know what fans I am of yours and of this podcast in particular. If I wasn't a journalist in my daytime job, I would be your publicist in a heartbeat, pro bono.
And we're very grateful for that. We really are. I want to start by talking about this documentary. You were in Israel twice after the war. You spoke to hostages who came back. Can you tell us your main takeaway after meeting these people who are through hell and back? I mean, will they ever be okay? Can they ever truly recover from what they went through?
I mean, how can anyone be okay? How can anyone ever truly recover? Even the lucky ones who had their loved ones come back, having experienced what they did over that time, some 50 plus days in captivity, held captive as hostages. These are innocent civilians. As we know, they range in age from young babies to the elderly. You've covered this quite extensively. As it turns out, I hadn't been to Israel prior to these two visits early this year. Over 25 years, I was there as a teenager. And every year it was like a running joke in my family and among friends. Next year in Jerusalem. Literally, I've been meaning to come. And sadly, it's taken the war to get me there. But I have to say, it was so important to see. Jonathan, I know you felt this too. It's one thing to report everything, and we have access to so much news being away overseas. But when you're there and you experience and you visit with these families, you visit the kibbutzim, you see the horrors of what happened on October 7th, and then you talk to these families who tell you every single day is October 7th for them because their loved ones are not home. And it's an ongoing nightmare that no one could ever imagine or put to words. But I'm really grateful that a lot of these families, I spoke with four of them, really opened up to me, invited me into their homes, talked about their loved ones, showed me pictures, showed me their bedrooms. You know, Omer Shemtov, 21 years old, was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival, and his mother has kept his room exactly as messy as it was on October 6th. And, you know, she says that the first thing I'm going to do when I see him is give him a big hug, and then I'm going to kick his ass and tell him to go clean his room. And that, in a nutshell, is every mom. And I think that's why this is so important, that we not forget these people, these hostages that remain, 134. I believe a quarter or more are believed to have been killed. But these are everyday people. And for a country to be that traumatized, a country that size, to have seen such loss at such scale, it's something we can't forget. And it's hard to believe it's already been 6 months.
When you say we can't forget, you're also saying we shouldn't forget. And I'm interested to know whether, sitting where you do in the American media, whether you have found it has been a struggle to get people to pay attention to this aspect of the story, given how much else there is, given every new twist and turn. People maybe don't want to go back to what happened then. But also because so many thousands have been killed in Gaza, whether there is in a way a drying up of sympathy for the hostage families, for Israelis, whether you're just, are you, to some extent, do you feel as if you're pushing against that?
Listen, I believe that humans, that Americans, that people around the world have room to absorb both and to have compassion for those in Gaza that are suffering. Wars are horrible, and we, CNN, like all of your news organizations around the world, have been covering this war extensively, and I'm proud of the work that we've done. But at the same time, you can have compassion, and your heart breaks for these families that have suffered a war that, you know, was brought upon them to their doorsteps. They are innocent civilians who were taken, and I think these two go hand in hand. I mean, in many ways, this war, this fighting, at least in the short term, comes to an end if these hostages come home. So it's a moral imperative that we continue to talk about both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. And we've interviewed many families. We continue to. And CNN, I'm really proud of the work that we've done throughout the network to continue interviewing them and talking about their stories and the importance of them coming home. When we talk about a ceasefire, it always comes with a condition that these hostages are released as well. And so it shouldn't be viewed as difficult. I can understand why, given that so much time has gone by, that so much death, so much suffering has been endured. But I think both of these can be covered objectively because they're two very important stories.
I'm taking you back to one of the personal stories. You spoke to Yarden Roman-Gat, who was abducted. She was actually, if I remember correctly, she gave her daughter, Geffen, to her husband, and then she was abducted. And she told you a very interesting story about what she heard from her captors. It maybe puts this whole kind of war into some sort of perspective.
You know, interviewing Yarden, and for viewers or listeners, you'll probably recall that she was the first Western interview, 60 Minutes conducted an interview with her shortly after she was released in November. But it's another reminder that, yes, people may be free physically, but she's clearly still traumatized by the experience. And she talked at length about the suffering, the torture of having your freedom taken away when somebody is with you every second. I said, was a terrorist sitting with you every single day? She said every second. Mm-hmm. That she didn't have time to think, time to be on her own. And obviously knowing that her daughter, her three-year-old daughter, who she was so smart to realize that her husband, they had a moment after they'd been kidnapped where they could escape. And her husband is an avid runner. And she decided in that moment that it was worth the risk of giving Geffen to her husband alone, who ended up running. And they luckily were not taken back into Gaza, but she sadly was. But just knowing that her husband and her daughter were free, I think gave her a lot of strength. But I asked her about some of the conversations that she ultimately had with the terrorists, with her captors. She understands a little bit of Arabic, and they spoke some English. And ultimately, she said, and this was so chilling, that they wanted jihad. And that was their ultimate goal. And she asked, why are you doing this? What is it you want to achieve? You know, they said what we've heard other released hostages say, that the kibbutzim are not your land. That's our land. That's Palestinian land. But she said this extended far beyond the Middle East, far beyond Israel ceasing to exist. No such thing as a two-state solution where the two Palestinians and Israelis can live side by side. It was a jihad, and a global jihad is what they were seeking. At one point, she said, listen, and she was just trying to calm the situation. She said, I also have German citizenship. Maybe I can just go live there. And they said, well, yeah, we have Hamas in Germany too. You're not safe there either. And that was a message that she really wanted to convey and that her brother conveyed too when he spoke before the UN. And it's a reminder that these people were far from right-wing activists. Her brother had been a peacenik for many years. Many of the people that reside in the kibbutzim were all about peace. It's one of the reasons, as you know, geographically, why they were so close. And they had so many relationships with Palestinians. Again, she wasn't speaking for every Palestinian, but these were her Hamas captors. Mm-hmm. And I found that quite chilling and stunning to hear that these conversations were had.
Yeah. One thing Yoni and I noticed very early on in this is how women have one way or the other been central in this story in terms of the hostages taken, the hostage families, mothers and sisters and wives talking about hostages who and those behind. Of course, as things went on, more and more information came to light about the sexual violence that was committed on October the 7th and subsequently to the women held captive. A big part of your reporting on CNN has been about that. And you've been sort of pushing that in some ways against a current in the rest of the media around the world. And I wonder just what your perspective is on that and why you think it's in a way required somebody like you to do that. Why has there been a reluctance, not just in the media, but in UN agencies and other bodies, to talk about that?
I'm so glad you brought that up. And it's a question I continue to ask myself. I think it's pretty apparent, given the number of investigations now 6 months in, that these atrocities happened, that women were systematically raped, tortured. There's concern. Obviously, the UN envoy on sexual violence in war zones, who spent time in Israel 5 months after October 7th and conducted numerous interviews. You've covered this. I know, Yonit, you interviewed Pramila Patton as well. I mean, in her report, she said, not only did we see concrete evidence of this, but the concern is that it's ongoing. And that is why there's so much heightened fear and concern for those remaining female hostages. And we've heard testimonies from released hostages. And you can understand, in any circumstance that involves sexual assault, you always have trepidation, fear, difficulty of having the victims come forward for understandable reasons. But in this situation, when you're at war, when you still have a number of women who are at risk, it's also understandable why they may not feel comfortable speaking publicly about what happened, given what they know is likely happening right now to those that remain in Gaza. So for the life of me, I will never understand why this was a hill so many people chose to die on. They saw the atrocities firsthand. These terrorists recorded with GoPros. I mean, they clearly wanted the world to see what happened on, October 7th. And why, out of all atrocities and crimes, this is the one that's so difficult to believe is beyond me. But we knew early on, following the evidence and speaking to experts who said, listen, we're only following what we can confirm. There had been horrible reports that hadn't been confirmed. Pramila Patton knocked down some of those as well, saying there wasn't evidence to justify them. But everyone I spoke with said these things were so bad, there's no need to follow the lead on something we can't confirm. What we know now, what we can't confirm, these crimes against humanity, these war crimes, that's enough to focus on, which is why those were the experts that I spoke with. There's no need to sensationalize what's already a horrible story.
Yeah, I mean, but you've been so pivotal in raising the awareness on this. And it's just, I remember looking at you and saying, that's so courageous. And this shouldn't have been a courageous thing to do, to run against this current of the world sort of not dealing with this or not wanting to see this. I do want to raise one more thing with you, which is the issue of anti-Semitism. And again, you've been vocal on that, particularly maybe about what we've seen in college campuses, being Jewish, raising Jewish children. Are you somehow optimistic that this genie that we've seen sort of explode out of the bottle can ever be returned to the bottle after this is over?
you know, I'm a very optimistic person, and I turn to your podcast. I mean, honestly, your war therapy, I should commend you for that war therapy podcast that got nominated for an award. You should win all the awards for that, because that was such a therapeutic episode for me to listen to, and clearly it resonated with people around the world. I would like to think of myself as an optimist. I mean, that's at the core of what America is all about. It's why, you know, my parents are probably the most patriotic people I know, because they moved here as immigrants. They chose to come here. It's all about the light at the end of the tunnel. Sadly, anti-Semitism didn't start on October 7th, as we know. It's been with us for many, many millennia, and it has been percolating. It's been an issue we've been dealing with. It's been on the rise in the U.S., around the world, and it didn't happen in a vacuum. The scale that we've seen since October 7th has surprised me, and I worry that there aren't enough tools and resources out there for people to utilize to really address this head on. You know, no one blames me for anything that's happened, you know, in the Soviet Union, for Vladimir Putin's actions. And you've had guests that have brought this on. And yet when it comes to Jews, whether or not they agree with what's happening in this war under the direction this war has taken. And by the way, even before the war began, it's, you know, right after these atrocities took place, you saw anti-Semitism spike. These are conversations that I just never thought I would have to deal with raising my children in New York City, of all places. So I'm in the short term not optimistic. I'm glad we're addressing it, but I think this is something we should really, really be concerned about, you know, for months and years to come, even when this war is over, because clearly this has been out there, it's been percolating, and it's just been given a platform now. But as you know, this is a terrible cancer that needs to be put to an end. And sadly, it's remained with us for so many years.
Bjana Golodryga, your reporting has been really important and really valuable. And we're very grateful for you coming on Unholy.
And coming home, a special edition of The Whole Story with Anderson Cooper, 8 Eastern on Sunday, which is exactly the 6-month mark. Bjana, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, guys. And I should note to your earlier point, if I can, Jonathan, about CNN covering both the tragedy unfolding in this war and the terrible death toll. You know, this is an hour special where we focus on 4 families, but throughout it, you see the devastating consequences that Palestinians are enduring, innocent Palestinians, after this war began too. So you'll see both of that in this episode.
So if you are on the East Coast of the United States, a reminder that you can see Bjana Golodryga's documentary about the hostages and the hostage families at 8 p.m. Eastern that night. And people, I think, on CNN International, elsewhere around the world, can definitely see that. And it was great to hear from her. She has been really important in terms of what she's been doing throughout this whole 6-month period.
Yes, very important and really pivotal in these important moments. This was quite a show, but we cannot end it without our traditional mention chutzpah. Tough competition this week, but I think after hearing this report on NBC, the fact that Strategic Affairs Minister here in Israel, Ron Dermer, probably the closest person to Benjamin Netanyahu, according to this report, became angry and yelled at senior U.S. officials during an online meeting to discuss plans for a military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. I mean, do we need to explain or extend this, just in the sense that Israel is already under heavy, you know, criticism from the Biden administration? This is Israel trying to convince or to sort of get more support from the administration vis-a-vis the Rafah operation that Israel still wants to do. Maybe not the best idea to yell at American officials after everything that the United States has been doing supporting Israel in the past 6 months.
Yeah, it's a good test in if there's a fiery exchange. Who is the needy party here? And if you're the needy party, you don't get to yell and shout on the Zoom call, I think is the rule of thumb. As for Mensch, I think there won't be much competition or protest if we say that the staff volunteers, founder of World Central Kitchen, has brought the world's attention on them just this week, but obviously for many, many months. And what they have managed to do and are trying to do, I think it's very clear that they are engaged in an act of Menschlichkeit and therefore are obvious winners of this week's Mensch Award. If you have got things from listening to Unholy, of course, do tell your friends in all the usual ways.
Yes, it has been our special edition for the six-month mark. Let us hope for much better news in the next 6 months. And we'll say our thank yous to Omer Primat and Omri Barak and Gaia Glaser. And we shall meet next week, just as usual, Jonathan.
See you then, Yonin.
See you.